Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. Molly Gagger around the intro, episode 241. Irby, I don't think Lucas really considered how high pitched that song is. Was that rattling your ears the way it was mine? I didn't have it up loud. But damn.
I'm never gonna complain. What do you, Lucas? You gotta put that on John Williams. It's all John Williams. George let John have free reign, but I'm never gonna complain about Star Wars stuff. I'm glad that you got the memo that we did not open with Star Wars last week on Star Wars Day, but you got it this week. So thank you. Thank you.
I wanted to pay you back for that. I really did, because I felt bad about that. I did feel bad about that. I mean, it was May 4th, after all. I did feel bad about that. I did want to give you a solid for this show. But you know, now that I'm thinking about it, considering our opening topic, I should have gone with the Imperial song. that's
solid.
You know what that is? That you know what that is? That is being in the middle of a very busy, hectic work day and just not having time to put a lot of thought in the opening song. That's my bad. That's on me.
Hey, that's what it is.
Anyway, so this happened last night. I want to talk to you about this before we get into the rundown. And of course, you know, obviously, once Samantha joins on, we can get her three things that she wants to bring up this week. But I want to talk to you about this because this happened last night. And mind you, I didn't watch the whole game. I'm only catching snippets. I'm catching highlights. So if I say something that happened that didn't happen or vice versa, that's why. Please forgive me for that. But this is from my vantage point, watching this unfold via highlight reel. I think it's a fair way of putting it there, Irby. I really do. Playing the Blue Jays in New York. Blue Jays up 3. Stanton ties it with a 3-run home run. A home run that game reports were suggesting were, not just suggesting, flat out calling them Yankee Stadium cheapies. Thank you, Woodward, for that one. Ties it at 3. Later in the inning, Donaldson gets hit. And this is where things go awry, because it's the 6th inning. We're tied at 3. The umpires gather, and I don't think I've ever actually seen this before. They get together, and mind you, to my knowledge, no warnings were given by the umpires to either bench. Okay, let me make that clear because of what's about to happen. The umpires get together. They huddle up for quite some time. And they come to the conclusion that Garcia, the Blue Jays reliever, didn't intentionally throw him out of the game. Then they throw the pitching coach out of the game because the pitching coach had a few words for the umpires. Fast forward, later in the night, a Blue Jays player, I think it was Bichette that was at the plate, takes one up and in. I'm talking really up and in. When the Blue Jays dugout, rightfully so, has some questions for this umpiring crew that tossed their reliever out of the game for coming up and in, they toss the manager of the Blue Jays out. Now, I don't think this had any impact on the game itself. The Yankees ended up winning in walk-off fashion 4-3. None of these events that transpired affected the game. I'm not saying that the Blue Jays have some right to play this under protest or anything like that. Like, this is how the game went. But I'm looking at a couple of things here, Irby. I'm looking at – we've talked on this show many times about how the ball is slick. You shouldn't go up and in. Players are going up and in. People are getting hurt. People are getting hit by baseballs. They're getting hit by pitches. Gone through all that, what do these umpires think the intent was? Because I don't know any baseball player, maybe outside of John Lackey or Vicente Padilla. Those are the only two pitchers I know of in the history that in the recent history of baseball, pitchers that I watched. That's the only two I know of that would hit a player intentionally tied at 3 at Yankee Stadium in the sixth inning. That's the only two I know of. These umpires get together. No warning had been issued. They toss this guy. But, it's, you know, the Yankees come up and in. It's perfectly okay. I'm not saying these umpires were, you know, pro-Yankee and they were discriminating against the Blue Jays. I'm saying this was another ump show. And we've seen this repeatedly. I brought it up last week with Mad Bum. That was ump show. Now we got another ump show. I don't know what's going on with these umpires, Irby, but it's starting to get a little ridiculous.
I'll start there. Started. No, we're past starting. We're full blown into ridiculous. Simple explanation for this one. Crew chief was Alfonso Marquez. And there's a reason when this stuff happens, and there's choice words to add, or word stuff. When this stuff happens, there's reasons we see the same umpires over. I mean, it's the same umpires over and over again. I'm sure Angel Hernandez saw the highlights of this later and got upset that he wasn't involved and he wasn't on TV. But I mean, it's the same guys over and over again. So that's why, I mean, yeah, when we were talking about this and looking it up and reading about it, as soon as I saw Marquez's name, I'm like, oh, okay, cool, makes sense. And even better is he addressed it afterwards. So I guess earlier in the game, the Toronto catcher, backup catcher, Tyler Heineman,
sure,
and Donaldson had got into an exchange of words. Per Marquez, he said, there were pretty strong words. Then you have a game-tying home run and the second pitch, which we deemed intentional, which was the reason for the ejection. All that really played into it.
Let me ask you something. You were a catcher.
I was.
One time. I played baseball. Okay? I've had my own exchanges with catchers while I was in the batter's box. Conservative estimate, give me a percentage. How often do exchanges like that happen between a catcher and hitters?
Every game. There's conversations. There's whining. There's conversation. I mean, it's stuff. It's discussion. That's even what Donaldson said. That's the best part is Donaldson was asked, and he even said, it wasn't intentional.
Yeah.
Great. It's that moment of, and I've been a part of, in my high school days, of incidents like this where I got in trouble once as a catcher for beaning a guy. It was for the exact opposite reason. He was upset that we beamed him, and I pointed out the fact that, no, we actually just gave away a base runner because you're an easy out. I mean, we ain't trying to hit you, man. You're not very good. Of course, we're upset. And then I was also part of an incident with a similar, like, Marquez, Angel Hernandez situation like this where an umpire was having I don't know what the issue is. I mean, young enough, I will play that card of what the issue was. But it was enough that both coaches were upset. And that right there is it. When you have both sides confused of what you're doing, you've lost control of the game. Your job is to guide the game. It's to umpire the game. It is to manage the game forward. It's not to be a part of the game. There's a huge issue right there. You are not to be a part of this. You are to be invisible. Obviously not physically invisible, but essentially invisible. You are not part of this. And that's the problem of what Major League Baseball is dealing with, is, for lack of a better term, we have diva umpires. We have umpires who I'm surprised some of them aren't out there, you know, taking selfies of themselves or TikToking themselves doing some of these things and trying to get some social following. But that's essentially what this is. We have umpires who are inserting themselves into the results of baseball games. That's the problem. Not the ejections and, oh, you know, you threw this guy out but not that guy. It's not that. It comes down to that core problem of you have these divas who want to be a part of the conversation, and you're not supposed to be. We're not supposed to know the names of umpires, referees. That's the reality.
Yeah. Well, see, that's the thing. Okay. NFL referees screw up all the time. We all know that. And it's not necessarily their fault. There's so many different rules in the NFL, so many different things. Like you need one of those CSI boards that has, you know, yarn going to this and that to figure out what the hell to call. They stumble into notoriety. Major League umpires, they advocate for it. They want it. They're like Jerry Jones wanting the glory in Dallas. These are umpires. They want the glory of the game. For whatever reason, they seem to think that people come to watch them umpire the game instead of, I don't know, the $300 million shortstop playing baseball.
Yeah, and I mean, that's exactly the issue. It goes away from the conversations and all that stuff, and it's that you're inserting yourself and making yourself part of the dialogue. You know, a documentary, I'm not going to cut. I mean, there's just no other way to put it. There's no antidote. There's no comparison or anything. Umpires, this old guard of umpires, we got rid of Wes. Hopefully Angel's on his way out in the near future. Marquez is another one. It's this level of you have to stop being a part of it. I mean, we had the Jerry Davises was another issue. And I'm blanking on, there's another one, too, it drove me up a wall. I actually was checking my time hop the other day, and I complained about him, like, 6 years ago. I'm like, oh, that didn't change. But it's guys like that. I mean, Jerry Davis will infamously be known as the one who threw out Adrian Beltre as he's moving the on-deck circle. And the best thing about that is if you ever watch that video, just watch how Jerry's moving. I'm not trying to make fun of him, but I'm going to. Just watch how he's moving. I mean, it screams old man on the lawn yelling at clouds. Like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Why are you inserting? Like, this is the, you know, it's, I coach kids baseball. I play softball still. And we walk up on these fields and I get excited sometimes because I see the umpires. I mean, there was one at play yesterday. Where the umpire, he just had a bad view. There's only two field umpires. He didn't have a great view. He called out. We're all sitting there still, you know, we're on the dugout. Oh, no, I mean, he's safe. You know, we were certainly safe, and I really do think he was. We get out in the field. I go out to shortstop, and he walks right by me and goes, hey, from my angle, he looked out. That's the best I can do. That's all I mean. So I appreciate it. He's human. It's like, look, the angle I have, that's what I saw, okay, and I'm going to stick with it. I'm not asking you to change it. Hey, if you're man enough to say that right there, that's great. But this right here, I mean, to say the, I mean, maybe it goes to this shows that if the umpires got together and they deemed that the heated exchange of words followed by the home run, or then the home run, then the plunking of the guy who was involved in the heated exchange, where if that's how if you're looking at that, yes, there was intent, then they've lost touch with the game of baseball, and that's a bigger problem.
What? Well, that's the thing. That's the thing. Like, I question the baseball IQ of these umpires that think that somebody would intentionally hit a player in a 3-3 tie in a sixth inning at Yankee Stadium. Why would you do that?
Yeah.
Again,
Exactly.
John Lackey, maybe. Vicente Padilla, definitely. But... I don't think Garcia was throwing at Donaldson. Nobody thinks he was throwing at Donaldson except for this group of ragtag umpires that got together for, again, a long – I've never seen a conversation this long because a player got hit and they're trying to go around the table determining intent. It's almost like they were trying to figure out which umpire was going to tell him he was thrown out. Okay, you know what, let's bring Samantha in. Samantha, we're talking – Yankees Blue Jays last night. Did you see this incident that went down in the later innings? No. Okay.
No, I did not see this. It sounds like someone got thrown out because they thought they were trying to hit a batter or whatever. But I don't know. Look, man. Like, my opinion on this is, like, these guys have to make a judgment call on this all the time. And if they throw the guy out, everybody complains that there's no way in that situation it was intentional. And if they don't throw the guy out, everybody says, yes, but it's still dangerous. So
that's true.
It's lose-lose. We have no rules. That's the problem. We don't have a rule for this. I mean, we can say that they're not following the rules. There is no rule. It's a judgment call, you know. So Also, who wouldn't want to hit Josh Donaldson? I totally understand that. I would throw at Josh Donaldson, too. Like, someone needs to hit that guy with a baseball.
You know what's funny about this whole thing, though, Irby? Like, you mentioned Joe West. Like, I don't think Joe West's vanity would allow him to do what these guys did last night, because it would have – every part of it looks bad on the umpire, and that wasn't Joe West's style. Adrian Hernandez? Yeah, sure. I don't think Joe West would have done it. Last thoughts on this one, Irby, before we get into our rundown.
I did remember – Stevie Buck, that was the other umpire. Stevie Buck, another one that loved to insert himself whenever opportunity arise.
Oh, man. Well, regardless, and look, I mean, this is all talk show, you know, content, what happened. Again, this isn't why the Blue Jays lost to the Yankees last night. They lost in walk-off fashion to the Yankees because you gave up a home run. The umpires and what they did, it's just for people like us who like to talk about these things. That's it. So, needless to say, let's get into the rundown here. Samantha, you're up. What three things do you have for us tonight?
All right. Well, let's start by coming back to the ball, which it seems we're going to have to keep doing until we get this right, which if you're depending on Major League Baseball to get this right, then, I mean, like, this whole notion, like, let's just start with what I actually want to talk about is drag data, but, like, I kind of want to get out of the way first this idea that, like, we have players coming out and saying that the ball is traveling farther during nationally televised games and that they think they're using a liver ball for those. Like, you guys, they can't get anything right. They're not that organized. Do you really think they designated a creative baseball for Sunday Night Baseball or MLB Network that is a live creative ball? Do you think Major League Baseball has any idea what's in any of those crates? No, that's part of the problem we have. They don't know what they're doing. They're not that organized. Like, it's like everybody stop with that. This is like ridiculous conspiracy theory. But what I really want to talk to you guys about is drag data, because they have dropped, if you go on Baseball Savant, they've dropped the first set of drag data for the season. And you can find that, you know, I think you can even get to it probably through the MLB app or something. It's pretty easy to find. So drag coefficient is mostly what we're talking about here. Drag coefficient, coefficient of restitution, which is basically like the impact of exit velo off the bat. So if you have a drop in drag, then of, let's say, 0.01 drop in drag coefficient on like a roughly 100 mile an hour exit velo ball, the ball is going to go 5 feet farther. If you have a 0.01 increase in drag coefficient, the ball is going to travel 5 feet less. So when you look at the data, and they will give you this data since 2016 because that's what we have, that's when we started tracking this, and you look at sort of the average drag coefficient of the ball on the season, so it looks about like 16 looks this year so far, which is like eek, because that's pretty much the worst. So more drag, not good. However, why this is happening is another issue. Part of it is the dead ball, for sure. We know it's a deader ball this year. We know that. But I think there are some other things in play here, some of which they can control. And like, remember a week ago when I was yelling about how Major League Baseball said they couldn't control drag? Here we are. yes, they can. Raise the steam.
They do it all
rough
the time.
The surface. Like, and claiming they don't understand how to change the surface of the ball, but they certainly know how to raise the seams. We've heard players talking about when they think the seams are higher or lower on the ball that year. It comes every year in spring training. We get a story about this one. Pitchers are swearing, seams are up, seams are down. It's different than last year. Pitchers, they cry about everything, right? So we always know. So, okay, sure, the dead ball's part of it. But other things come into play here. This humidor in every park business, which is something they can control. There's a way to control the drag coefficient. Don't put humidors, or you want to put a humidor in every park, fine. Don't put the balls in it at the beginning of the year in the northern part of the country when it's already wet and cold. Like, why are we doing that? And then, of course, there's the weather, which is also going to affect drag and make the ball travel less far because it has been cold and wet. in the northern part of the country. That's the part they can't control. That's the thing they ought to be leaning on, you know, instead of just saying, we can't control drag, because, yes, you absolutely can. What they should be saying, at least from a PR standpoint, if they're not going to do anything about this, is say, well, the weather's been bad. That's contributing to the problem, because that's true. But no matter what, I mean, it's bad. Like, I think 2019, of the years where we have the data, 2019 is the one when we had the lowest average drag coefficient. So, and if you look at the numbers for hitters, it pretty much matches up, because then it's 2017, 18, 20, 21, 16, respectively. Now, we don't have a ton of data for this year yet, obviously, but it looks, if you look across the chart, which you can go on Baseball's Online, you can look at it for yourself, where we're seeing, like, the cluster, which is going to be the average, looks about like what it looks like in 2016. So not great for a sport where we are claiming that the long-term goal is to increase offense.
Yeah, this is, again, this is what drives me bananas, because, of course, they can control drag. Okay?
Yeah.
Coming out and trying to convince people of this is absurd. You look at
the
data
on
sport,
their
the ball
website.
Stays the same. Right, thank you. Right, you look at every other sport, the ball is always the same. Baseball, for whatever reason, wants control, more control over the baseball that's used than NBA wants over basketball, and the NFL wants over football. They want the control there because they can cookie cutter this, right, Samantha? They can say, okay, this year we want more offense, so we're going to lessen the drag. Or next year we want more pitching. We had too many home runs last year. We want more pitching. We can't go back to the steroid era and have any tie-ins. So we can't have a live ball anymore. So now that they've been struggling to figure out the compromise ball over the last handful of years. And I don't see any end in sight here. At what point do they finally just settle on a baseball and stick with it for a while?
Well, yeah, and part of the problem is like, I think that the way that you do, because what they're trying to do is increase offense while also decreasing free throw outcome on baseball, because it's boring, right? We want to see contact. We don't not want to see home runs. We just want to see more people make contact and we can get on base. So the ball is probably not the thing to go after if that's your ultimate goal. I mean, we can talk about two different things, a juice ball and reducing drag are two completely separate issues regarding the ball. But to me, the ball, unless we're just talking about, well, we'd rather have more offense, we'll eat the home run, make a live ball. Okay, fine. But if we're really trying to hit this happy medium where we cut down on true outcome baseball, including the walks and the home runs, including the things that are positive for the hitters, and we encourage contact, then what we need to do is, I mean, part of it, I think some of this is unavoidable. I don't envy them the task of figuring out what to do about the fact that we have all these people who are throwing like 100. You can't do anything about that. I mean, what are you going to do? Tell them they have a flow slower? Like, that's not going to help. Pitchers throw too hard. That's part of the – and maybe you juice the ball more to make up for that. But if you want to cut down on the other stuff and get away from this 3-2 outcome baseball, then you need to do something about shift for one thing. That's part of this. You also need to do something about the way that people roster players, because if you're going to allow people to carry this many pitchers, or even, I mean, I've heard it, but, you know, some people put it out there, and I'm not sure it's the perfect solution, but it might be something we'd want to think on, is if you say you can only use 5 pitchers in a game, accepting injury, that might help. Because then, I mean, almost every tech advantage we have favors the pitchers, right? So you have to do something analog, essentially, to combat this, because you can't change how hard people throw, and you can't change the fact that hitters have gotten bigger, so the ones who are good at it, who can succeed in spite of the hard throw, in spite of, and I started reading stuff about, I just kind of gotten comfortable with all the drag stuff, and now I'm kind of getting into this stuff with the bat, which is a little bit different about sort of how to maximize that, and, you know, there's some stuff we can look into there, but I don't feel educated on it enough yet. I mean, I have to research everything to the ends of the earth. Irby, you appreciate this. So if I don't look see this thing through to, you know, 18 to 20 hours of research. I'm not comfortable talking about it, but there's probably something to do there. But, I mean, restrictions on pitching changes is probably the easiest way to cut down on this. Because, yeah, it's freaking boring, man. Home runs, strikeout, walk. It doesn't make for exciting baseball. You want to see cops. Right? So, I mean, you're absolutely right. Like, we're looking at a ball that, needs to solve two problems, and that's just impossible. So we need to solve it another way.
Uh-huh.
Or you could just juice it and say, the hell with it. Let's have a live ball. Let's have all of our games end 15 to 12. That would certainly bring in a lot more casual fans.
Words in the 90s.
Not totally right, opposed to that. I think people were pretty happy then.
All right, before I hand this over to Irby here, because I do want your opinion on this, Irby, I have a question, Samantha, and if I am completely around the bend on this one, let me know, because it's possible I am. Maybe I'm getting a little too into this, but at what point does the ball become a negotiating part of the CBA?
Well, yeah, I mean, no, you're right. You're not around the bend at all on that. There was certainly some talk of why did they not address this since we were negotiating a CBA this year, and it's not something that would necessarily have induced a work stoppage or prevented the end of a work stoppage in general. So it's, a lot of people are looking at it, yes, as a missed opportunity. Why did we not do some negotiation on the ball? I think the bigger question is, why is Major League Baseball insisting on being so insular? Why are you not reaching out to, like, NPD and talking to them or KBO and saying, like, hey, I mean, we know, okay, it's a proprietary substance.
Yes.
Do you really think they will not sell that recipe to Major League Baseball if they put the money out there? Like, these are not necessarily competing leagues. Like, they're not trying to keep it from you. They just want to be compensated for what they've got. So why aren't we doing that? And why isn't the union pushing for that? I mean, to me, it's like, I don't know why anybody would be against it. I mean, I think we have to stop kowtowing to the every sensitivity of pitchers. That's part of the problem here, is that you know, when they tried the tackier ball before, the pitchers were like, I don't like how it feels in my hand. I don't like touching it. You know, like, and you're like, man, buck up. You want this sport to be popular or not? You want to get paid more? Like, if more people watch baseball and it gets more popular, you too will get paid more, whining pitcher. So, let's stop letting pitchers be these ridiculously fragile, like, absurd little things that can't handle any modicum of change, and they all freak out. Like, oh, you know what? Then I guess maybe, like, you're just going to get lit up for a year. And I bet you'll all adapt.
I mean,
y'all adapted to the sticky stuff thing.
How about, you know, how about you, as a pitcher, realize you're a professional, a major league pitcher, and you just deal with the ball given to you? I mean, I think back, Irby, I think back to late night, Greg Maddux comes to mind. The guy threw 90 miles an hour on a good day and still put together a Hall of Fame career in the live ball era. You just pitch better.
Well, you're making life too easy for, as Samantha perfectly placed it there, these delicate people who stand on a mound and have to throw down hills and whine about it. Sorry, lifelong catcher. I have 0, 0, 0. Shut up. I mean, why is Major League Baseball full of catchers as managers and not pitchers? There's a reason. Catchers are more important. Whatever, whole other subject.
So true.
And this is where, and if I'm way off, jump in here, Samantha, and tell me I'm off. But part of the problem is it doesn't seem like Major League Baseball even knows what they're trying to accomplish here. Like have they ever publicly stated what
exactly
they're trying?
No, that's right, Irby.
And there's
exactly
a problem.
Right.
Like this is doing science just to do science. It's like, look at these cool experiments and look at these things that we can do and we can change this and that. Like, what are you trying to accomplish? Well, but we can change the ball. What are you trying? Like, what is the end game? What is the product we're trying to get to? And that's the issue. I mean, yeah, you look at this drag data. I mean, it is a great graph where it breaks down the last 7 years and everything beside it, because any progress to improving efficiency or effectiveness or any kind of progress whatsoever, you would look at this and go, there's nothing here. Like, this is abstract art. This thing is abstract art. Baseball could probably sell this, and it would end up in the Louvre. There's nothing here. The lines don't correlate with anything. It's like there's no consistency. It's they're trying things just to try them. And no organization does that, period, at the professional level. Let me rephrase it. No successful organization does that. You don't try things just to try it. Engineers don't go, hey, let's take that piece off and see what happens. No, they theoretically work through, okay, well, this happens, this, and that, so if we take that off, it should do this. They have a good idea of what's going to happen. But it's like the Michael Scott thing from The Office where baseball is, yeah, we began this project and we totally lost track of where we're going and we don't even know where we're ending up, and hopefully at some point we get to a conclusion. Like, they have no idea where they're going. And that's the problem, is as long as you have no end product, as long as you have no end game of what you're trying to accomplish, then you're not going to accomplish anything here. And so we're going to keep having years like 2016 and then suddenly 2019. And now we're going back up. So 2022 will be like 16, and then we'll slowly go back down, where maybe if we can keep that consistency by 2025 will be a big offensive year. So teams can start prepping for that. Then we'll back to offense in 2025, 2028 back to pitching, 31, and we just continue that. I mean, at least if you do that, then okay, fine. But there's so many, and this is where I'm sorry to keep this going scientific, but when you change variables, any scientific process, you don't change variables just every other day. You don't consistently change variables. You have to get some consistency. Then you make small tweaks. Baseball's changing everything. Okay, well, let's do this, and now we're going to change this seam, but we're going to do humidors on everybody, and then we're going to not do humidors, but we're going to make this one 57%, but these guys are 60%, but then the seams are going to go back. If you're changing all these variables, you're going to get no real data here. You're going to get coincidence, not correlation. And there's, I guess, my second problem here. You have no end product. You have no goal in mind. And two, you're going to get something based on coincidence, not correlation. And when that happens, it won't consistently happen.
Samantha, anything you want to add to that before we get to your next topic?
Just that he's absolutely right. I mean, this is like those old monster movies, right? The mad scientist in the lab with like 1,000 beakers, and they're just like, let's just dump everything in and see what happens, and boom, it turns into a werewolf or whatever. And you're like, oh, I wasn't counting on that. Like, ooh, no. But, Irby, that was an outstanding point you made about changing every variable at once, because it's like they're just doing stuff. Like, we're going to try this, we're going to try this. It's like, no, you have to keep everything consistent. Try one thing. See how that works. Try the next thing. Like, it's not that we necessarily needed them to get it right immediately the year after they realized it was a problem. But, yeah, the jumping around of this, like, this is doing stuff. Like, there's nothing scientific about this. It's frightening considering how much data and how many people who are so good at understanding it we have in baseball, and we can't figure this out. And a lot of the problem is because none of the people who understand it work for Major League Baseball.
Yep. Although, I think at this point, I need some, like, PSAs for some baseball that have beakers in it. Anybody else? No?
Yeah.
Like, I need it.
I'm always down for beakers. Absolutely.
What else do you have for
me? Yeah, well, it's kind of time-consuming one. So here's the quickie. Just touching on Rowdy Tellez and the Milwaukee offense. So this is interesting, and I guess I'm more asking a question than making a statement, but, like, where are we at? How legit is this? You know, I mean, he's currently hitting .245. He's a career .247 hitter. He's got 7 home runs on the year. Like, his WAR is .4, but his career WAR is 1.1. But, you know, he's never played a full season. You know, 2019, I think, was the closest he came when he played 111 games. So last year he played 106, split between Toronto and Milwaukee. So, like, who is this guy? I mean, I don't know. What do you guys think? Who is this guy?
I think this is the textbook definition of a watch and follow player. right? Like,
mm-hmm.
Okay, maybe, but I need to see two things. I need to see, one, that he can play more than the 106, 111 games in a season. I need to see that. And I also need to see this home run clip last more than a couple of months. Because right now, this looks like a fly in the pan. This looks like a, hey, look at me real quick. I want to see where he's at come September.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think if you're going to be a 250 hitter, slightly below 250 hitter, you got to be hitting home runs consistently.
You got to be hitting home runs.
Right now,
you got to be hitting home runs.
We're getting two, and you got to walk.
I mean, Irby, I mean, you look at some of these power hitters in the game today, he's right on par with a few of them. So maybe he's becoming another Joey Gallo, for example. Maybe that's what he's turning into. I don't know. But this is a guy that wasn't on my radar until this year for a reason. I'm going to wait and see.
Well, and the one big drawback for his season this year, yes, there's some good numbers. The strikeout, as you mentioned, Gallo, the strikeout numbers definitely jumped up. His strikeout rates really haven't been terrible. But, again, like you guys pointed out, we haven't played full seasons. I mean, it's you know, 106 games last year, 35 in 2020, although that's, I mean, percentage-wise, it's very similar, and 111 in 2019. So, I mean, is that what he is? Is he that 100-game player? He's going to get in 100 games. If so, then, yeah, the walks I'd like to see go up. I mean, strikeouts is fine. But the peripheral numbers like that, these RBI, what he leads in RBI? Yeah, well, there's a lot of other factors that go into that one. So let's look at the stuff around it. And, yeah, I mean, it's nice to see the slugging it jump back up. I mean, was it a 414 slugging last year? Not so great. So, but yeah, good start. Someone to keep an eye on. He's got the – if he can stay on the field, he can stay healthy. Yes, we'll see what we have. But it's a nice start. Milwaukee, I mean, yeah, it's part of the reason why you're in first place, even though you just lost the series to the Reds. Thanks so much. I had a little personal stake in that one, so middle finger to the Brewers for that one. Thanks, guys. Appreciate y'all.
You could have got the Reds out of the way on that one if you wanted to. That's funny. Okay, maybe it's just funny for me.
It's so funny. No, it's funny. It's just still too soon, so the wound still hurts. So I'm not laughing.
Oh, boy. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, that was it. That's all I had on Rowdy. You're good. Sorry.
That's all you got?
Yeah.
Samantha, did we answer your question?
I guess the answer is there is no answer. But
really
we're
isn't,
not
yeah.
Yet, right? And Irby and I are both personally angry as Brewers. So.
Oh, man. I really am the only one laughing. Oh.
Okay. Which is not really Rowdy Gillespie's fault, but, you know, it's a fresh one. When did you text that to me? Or be like 4 hours ago? That one, 4 hours ago? It's fresh.
Yes, yeah. We're within a same day, half quarter day. Yeah, still too fresh. Could have been worse. Could have used my Dodgers pick. They lost the series to the Pirates.
Yeah, you're right. That was
yeah, but you also could have got the Pirates out of the way, too. I mean,
well,
okay.
If you picked the Pirates, which you wouldn't against the Dodgers, but sure.
I'm starting to think that maybe I should start picking these long shots just to get them out of the way. Okay.
That is part of the strategy. All right, last thing. I think this is super cool. If we want to talk about Kevin Gausman and his splitter, which is baseball's best chase pitch right now. So very Corbin Burns-like, as we all know, Kevin Gausman was on a very, very lengthy stretch of innings pitched without a walk. That ended in the series earlier this week against the Deans, but still really, really impressive performance. So people cannot lay off of this thing. It's incredible. I mean, and it's not usually when we see people with these extraordinarily low walk rates, it's because they're keeping it in the strike zone. But his in zone rate is actually 49.3. The league average is significantly above that. So why the lower walk? It's because people cannot lay off of this thing. So the chase rate, his chase rate, just in general, is 53.2%. The next highest is Max Fried at 40.5, followed by Buehler at 37.4, Musgrove at 36.4, and Dylan Cease at 35.4. So that difference, it doesn't sound like a lot, right? But the difference between where Gausman is at 53.2 and Fried at 40.5 is the same as the difference between Fried and the person who ranks 65th. So that is a huge, huge gap. And even more impressive, 72.4 of these chases are that splitter specifically. The next highest would be Heaney slider at 52, Logan Webb's change at 50.7, Kershaw's slider at 50, and Bieber's slider at 49.3. So this is the highest ever for a single pitch since 2008, which is when we started tracking this. And part of the reason he's been able to do this is because his four-seamer and his splitter look almost identical, almost the exact same spin axis. So people can't tell what this thing is, but it's really, really impressive. Like, this is, it sounds like small sample size, and to an extent it is, but the jump is so big between him and the competition and between him and essentially history. It tells you a lot about why he's doing as well as he is and why he's just not putting guys on.
That actually goes a long way to explaining a big question I've had about Kevin Gausman, because I've said this before on this show many times. Like, I watched Kevin Gausman a lot when he was younger, and I saw the struggles he had commanding his fastball. Now he's got this. Like, part of me wants to go what you're talking about, Samantha, which is, you know, small sample size. Yes, it is. That's true. You know, but if it's identical to his four-seamer, then you can't just say, well, you know, I'm just going to lay off the splitter. You can't do that when you're in the box. So at this point, it's going to fall on the scouting department. They've got to come up with his tendencies with the splitter. And, of course, you know, majorly scouting departments are good at this stuff, so they can come up with those tendencies. I think that obviously that rate will come down. But if it stays that identical to his four-seamer, even tendencies, Samantha, I don't think are going to get you out of that doghouse very soon.
Right, and that's the magic bullet in all this, right? It's like, because of the way it looks, because it's an identical or near-identical spin axis, then it creates, I mean, we can debate until the cows come home about whether tunneling exists or whatever, but, like, I'm in the camp that it does, even if it's not necessarily intentional. But this is essentially, it's tunneling, basically. This is an example of tunneling. And it is a nightmare for hitters. And to your point, which I'm so glad you brought this up, you said, I didn't trust Kevin Gausman before this. I wasn't that impressed by him. And that's because he wasn't throwing this splitter from the same release point as the fastball then. So is it a perfect pitch? No. It's because people can't distinguish it and they're chasing it out of the zone. He didn't have that matching release before between the two. Mm-hmm. So credit to the pitching staff, probably the Giants, I'm going to guess.
Yeah,
certainly wasn't the Orioles, probably the Giants. It could be the Blue Jays, but I doubt it. This is probably something that, like, if we go back and look at chase rate last year, I bet we would see this building as he got comfortable with it, got command of it, and learned how to drop it so that it looked like exactly the same as the four-seamer and matched the spin axis. So, yeah, and that's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up because, yeah, like, you didn't think much of him because you shouldn't, because he wasn't doing that because Orioles. So,
you know, and you, what's funny about those stats that Samantha just shared, he's still not spotting it. But because it looks like his four-seamer, Irby, they're waving at it. Like, that's what this is. The whole, like, one walk through how many starts he's had this year. Now it makes sense to me. He's not hitting his spots. He didn't turn into Greg Maddux in the offseason. He's making a wave at it, Irving.
Yeah, that's the fun thing to see. You guys are throwing up some good numbers and the progressiveness of where how things are going for him. Yeah, after six starts, 38 innings, you've got the one walk, 46 strikeouts. But the strikeout rate is very similar. But this goes back to, I think this is the induction of bad contact, the induction of because his line drive percentage, his ground ball, his ground ball to fly ball percentage, all these numbers, if you look at these numbers, hard hit balls, all these things, everything is very similar to last year. And not crazy high from the previous years when he was in San Francisco. He did 2 years there in Cincinnati before that, and in Atlanta before that. It's not huge numbers up. In fact, you could even make an argument like, batting average against him this year is up. Batted balls in play, about 370. So there's things that show that we can look at this and go, this actually could get better for what he's doing. You know, he's inducing bad contact, and it's going along with the strikeout rate, and it's cut down on the walks, as we mentioned. Because, I mean, yeah, it's 50 walks in 192 innings last year. It's not a terrible number. It's not a great number, but it's definitely an improvement. The guy also, he gave up 20 home runs last year, has yet to give up one this year. So I think this is a great example of, you know, and what's tough about it is that we saw Kevin when he was 22. He made his Orioles debut at the age of 22, and he became a regular in that lineup ever since then. So we have seen this young man for, you know, about 10 seasons. And that's why it's, you know, as Bo, your point was spot on at the time. It's like, it's not somebody you trust. You trust, he's now gotten to that point where you do trust them. And sometimes players like this spend their ages of 22, 23, 24, 25, all the way to 26, 27 in the minors figuring these things out. Gausman, it happened a little later in his career. Is it the change of address? Is it the coaching? You know, is it the pitchers he's around? You know, it's multiple factors like that make a difference. And this is where I always lean towards the coaching, because I think we see it at the professional level. We definitely see it at the college level, one Tim Corbin at Vanderbilt. But the Giants being a great example of that is these coaching staffs, these teams that, you know, the player should go there and suddenly the numbers get better. Gradually. Not over a long time, but gradually the numbers continue to get better and better and better.
Okay, Samantha, if you want to add to that before we get into Irby's topics.
Yeah, one last thing. Let's just tie this back, because Irby, you gave me the perfect opening for this when we started talking about inducing bad contact. Let's tie this back to the whole issue of drag and true outcome baseball and all that. So part of the reason this is working is because of the type of hitter he's tending to face. Because part of the reason we have three true outcome baseball is issues with the ball, yes, and issues with weather, yes. But it's also because, like we said, we have these pitchers throwing 100, and also because the hitters are getting bigger. And that happens to combat that we're looking for people who out-muscle it, right? So the bat, if you're talking about the batter, a bigger, heavier batter who hits for power has to start his swing earlier in order to put more kinetic energy into the bat. It's a very different approach than a timing guy. He doesn't have as much natural power, so he's going to be more selective. But in order to do what those bigger power hitters do, they have to swing earlier, which means they're going to make more mistakes. They're going to have to guess more. And the more of those kinds of guys we get, the more a pitcher like this can eat, because he is preying on your inability to correctly eyeball things. So you want to tie topics 1 and 3 together, there it is.
All right. Well, Irby, how about you? What three things do you have for us tonight?
Well, I was going to fit that. Yeah, good job tying 1 and 3 together. Amazing prop, mm-hmm. If you can somehow tie Rowdy Tellez into all that as well.
How about he would be one of those guys? Yeah, I mean, well, he would be one of those guys who would be sacrificing selection in favor of starting the swing earlier to put more kinetic energy into the bat in order to basically maximize on exit velo, bat angle, and barrels, essentially. So there we go. See, it all ties back together.
All comes back. Well, good. Then I'll jump into Royce Lewis. That's something he needs to learn if he goes forward. Because that's the point I wanted to bring in. Talk about our 2017 number one overall pick is finally in the majors. And I don't mean that in a negative way. Like, he's been for all along. I mean, it's a high school shortstop. And here he is, 22. He's finally got a shot, finally getting to see what he can do for Minnesota because of the Correa injury. Royce is up there. It's good for baseball. This is another great. We've talked about multiple of these names. And it's nice to see this. I always love looking at this, and 5 years always seems to be a good, solid number when we look at drafts, you know, 5 years later, where they are. And Royce Lewis, there's the one pick. Hunter Green, Mackenzie Gore, Kyle Wright, number five pick in there, Pavin Smith. At seven, doing great things for the Diamondbacks. Joe Adell got a shot, not so much. Keystone Hiura with the Brewers. Yeah. But with Trevor Rogers, another one getting the job done. Tanner Hawk, first round pick all the way down to Drew Rasmussen. So, 2017 draft, we're starting to see these players get regular play time, regularly be a part of these lineups. And I shows the success of this, shows the teams that draft well, and exciting to see. And all these great picks in there. And then I do love that right smack in the middle, the Oakland A's at number six, when they stretched for one Austin Beck, who doesn't play baseball. Whoop.
I mean, it's the A's. I didn't want to go with that. Samantha, it makes me wonder, you look at Royce Lewis and you look at what this kid brings. It's like, I think it solidifies what we all thought when they signed Correa to that weird 3-year deal, but with opt-outs every year. They don't expect Correa to stick around. Correa as a stopgap.
Yeah, in the weirdest way possible, but yes, you're exactly right. I think that's exactly what they did. They're not expecting him to stay. They're not going to pay him. I don't think they can, to tell you the truth. But it was kind of a win-win to them because they thought, okay, well, if Lewis isn't ready, then, okay, you know, you've got Correa for now. It's good PR in a way. I mean, it's Correa, so it's not good PR. But if you're the Twins and you're only thinking about, like, let's spend some money so we look like we mean business and your fans are, like, crumbling out in front of the trash cans. But anyway, I'm getting distracted. Point being that, yeah, I mean, it's worst case
scenario.
He does well and they don't, and they trade him at the deadline. So, and now, of course, Lewis has gotten his opportunity. So, but weird thing with Royce Lewis, like, here's what's weird about this and why people shouldn't, I would urge you not to panic if you're upset, you know, he's hitting 250, why doesn't he look there? He's only had 107 plate appearances in AAA because we had the COVID-shortened season in 2020, and last year he tore his ACL. So he has way, way less experience than most people who came in at that time, and particularly at the AAA level where it really matters. So 107 plate appearances. If this kid can't catch up in the majors, it doesn't mean he's not going to be good. It means he just might not be ready yet. So it was, you know, they had an opportunity. They called him up. Good for them for not pulling some service time shenanigans and holding him down and sticking some utility guy out there while Correa was on the IL, which I believe he is now officially on the IL as of today. But, yeah, if you're worried about Royce Lewis, why is Mero number one overall pick? Yeah, he probably needs some more seasoning in AAA. He just hasn't gotten the same number of opportunities at bats as you would expect him to, considering the amount of time that he's technically been a major league or a professional baseball player.
I just, you know, because it's the Twins, I have to point this out, throw this out there. I just hope I don't see him moving positions to keep him in the big leagues while they also have Correa on the roster. And that's really the only red flag I got for what they're doing right now.
No, let's hope not. But, yeah, it is a thought.
It's the Twins. Yeah. It's the Twins. You never know. All right, Urs, what else you got?
Well, all right, so the next thing, we're going to head out west, the National League West, where everybody is above 500 today. Fantastic. And one of those teams, yeah, everybody's above 500. And the fifth-place team, Rockies, are on a four-game losing streak, and yet they're still a game up 500. So, yeah, that makes sense. I love this game so much. Arizona Diamondbacks, probably one of the bigger surprises there. That's sitting at 17 and 15 with a negative in the run differential, but that is less with the pitching and more with the offense. So let's look at that pitching, who's getting the job done, especially on the front end. Now, I will tap in that this is all was placed, and I had this all prepared and everything, and then Mark Melanza and the bullpen gave up 8 runs in the top of the ninth to the Marlins today to blow that game 11-3. So, but still, that wasn't the starting pitcher, so I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm all right. Yeah. rotation. Yeah, raise your hand if you had this rotation looking this good. Merrill Kelly, Madison Bumgarner, yes, we know about it. Zach Davies, Zach Gallen, and Humberto Castellanos. All 5 starters whipped below 1.21. The worst DRA, Humberto at 4.32, but the rest of the guys, Gallen below 1. Bumgarner and Kelly both below 2. I mean, I know we've talked a lot about the pitching and becoming that side, but, I mean, is that a reason why we're seeing success from the Diamondbacks? Like, the pitching is getting the job done, and this is weird to see. Is it sustainable for the whole season? Probably not, but and Arizona's not going to pull one of these Giants moves from last year or anything like that, but these guys are winning series lately that we didn't think they'd be winning, and they're doing it with a rotation that's something you can definitely build on for the coming years.
You know, Samantha, this actually – I say this all the time. You know, they're about to turn into a pumpkin. That's the Diamondbacks. Like they're wearing their slippers right now. They're Cinderella. They're about to turn into a pumpkin. There's no way that they're able to maintain this through the entire season. It's one thing to be wrong about one player in a rotation. It's quite another to be wrong about 4. I just don't see this – I don't see this sustaining.
Well, yeah, I don't think they can continue winning as many games, but I don't know that necessarily means the rotation is going to crash and burn, because when we look at the Diamondbacks at the beginning of the year and said, this is not going to be a good team, you know, we weren't necessarily griping with the starting rotation, but there were a lot of question marks. So when you talk about the reasons that they are not going to be able to maintain this, they have no offense. The bullpen looks bad and getting worse. So the question becomes, yeah, like what can they do with this rotation? I mean, we have to assume you're absolutely right. They're going to come back. There's going to be some regression to me, for sure. Everybody's pitching over their heads. Like Graw and Mad Bum, okay, yes, we already knew about that. But Mad Bum is doing what we expected him to do. Right, so throw that out, throw out Zach Davies. Gallen was the guy I was really curious about, and he was the one who I would have said, this is a guy we need to see make the leap this year, and he's doing it. So that's not necessarily something I think is going to fall off. I think that is a very talented young pitcher who we were waiting to see, okay, is this going to be your kind of pot? Merrill Kelly, that's interesting. Humberto Castellanos, unfortunately, is probably my candidate for the guy who can't maintain this. I mean, he's been great, and I hope I'm wrong. I want all these guys to do well, obviously, because they're not on the trash cans, and we want everyone to do well and have a long career unless they are a trash can. But, yeah, I mean, let's say Mad Bum keeps it up, Merrill Kelly, maybe, I'm kind of excited about him. I think Gallen, very promising young talent. I mean, Davies is kind of pitching over his head. We don't know enough about him to know that. Castellanos, I think, is probably pitching over his head, and they don't have any help with their bullpen. I mean, we all, you know, you mentioned it, Melanson got lit up and is going to get lit up again. And we all love Mark Melanson, but he is not a very good pitcher anymore. And the offense is atrocious. So what we hope for the Diamondbacks, I think, is that if they can maintain at least the bulk of this rotation, if you can keep four guys doing pretty darn good, then you're going to win some baseball games, no matter how bad the rest of your club is. I mean, being standing wall about this. You can be really, really bad if you have four really good pitchers and still win a fair amount of baseball games. And then maybe that will put the Diamondbacks in a position where they can think about competing again.
Yeah. All right, Herbs, what else do you have for us? Last thing.
All right, well, so the last one, I did have a piece put together, and then current events always outweigh events that you want to do. So I will just shamelessly put it in there real quick. Love what Martin Perez is doing for the Rangers, and he got his first win finally, even though it wasn't a quality start. So moving on. More importantly, a fun topic to talk about, and I'm just going to put it out there, and I don't even really want to talk much about it because my words won't carry the weight. This is all about setting up somebody. This is about the softball toss. This is about the volleyball lob. So I'm going to set Samantha up real simply by just yelling, "Feed me! Feed me!"
You know, he did pick, there was an art film that was released and has since been taken down by a member of the Indians broadcast staff, the Indians, here we go again, Josh Naylor, man of the hour, man of the season maybe, straw that stirs the drink for the Indians, 8 RBIs after the 8th inning. That is a record. A grand slam in the 9th to tie a baseball game in which the Indians trailed 8-2 coming into the final inning in regulation, and then hits a 3-run homer in the 11th to secure the win. He went absolutely bananas after that. If you haven't seen video, DM me. I have a copy of it. It is no longer on Twitter because it is. Don't watch it with your kids. Put your headphones on. It is very NSFW, he is calling the pitcher's name. He is throwing everything he can get his hands on. He is screaming. I mean, feed me, feed me, feed me. You guys, feed me. It's a very censored version of this. I eat smoke. And then he called the pitcher some names. But he looked completely unhinged, and it was tremendous. And there are wonderful things going on in the background. Or you pointed out the Stephen Kwan, like, wow, I need to get out of the way of that. That's like twice my size, and it looks scary right now. And Fran Reyes is back there dancing, and then you can watch him kind of slow down once he starts to realize, oh, wow, this is going in a direction I'm not entirely comfortable with. But you know what? I don't blame Josh Naylor a bit for this. It's incredible. You know, when he was traded from the Padres to the Indians a couple of seasons ago, we watched this guy in the postseason that year. And I was talking to my mom about it, and we were like, this is the guy. This is the spark plug. This is going to be the guy who's like the clubhouse, get everybody revved up, keep everybody in every game. This is going to be the guy. And then he had a horrific injury last year, and it was one of those ones that you don't even like looking at it, you know, where the leg bends back the wrong way, and you're like, I don't know if you can come back from this at all. And he had his surgery. It was terrifying. Like, just one of those things where you don't want this to happen to really anybody, and you certainly don't want it to happen to a beloved player on your team, where we were asking questions like, is this guy really ever going to be able to play Major League Baseball again? You know, couldn't get out of his own home without help. Fortunately, he has a younger brother who is in the DM system in AA, who was able to kind of come up between games and help him out a little bit. But it was bad, you know. I mean, he was essentially out of commission, couldn't walk for a very long time, had really, really intensive surgeries. And he's beaten his timetable to come back. I don't think anybody expected much out of him at the beginning of this year. We didn't know if he'd play at all, like I said. He's killing it. I mean, yes, he had this great game, and it was wonderful, and I loved seeing him just get out there and just kind of lose his mind over it, because goodness knows, I think he earned it. But the crazy thing about it is, I mean, he's not having a game. He didn't just have a game. He's having a season. I mean, he has been absolutely outstanding at the plate. He's been as good as anyone can be defensively as a first baseman. He's just been incredible, and it's just such a great story. I mean, how do you not root for this guy, whether you like the DMs or not? Just absolutely outstanding performance, and so cool to see. And we got the added bonus of the, you know, hilarious video of him kind of losing his mind over it, which is tremendous.
I mean, it's certainly well deserved, you know, to go on that type of a celebration. But you know, it's always just incredible to me to see athletes, you know, when they have an injury like that. And it's almost like they take the prognosis as a challenge. It's like, yeah, okay, doc, you know, you say that, but I'm going to do this. And when they're able to actually come back early from an injury like that and to do what Naylor is doing, like, yeah, that's something pretty incredible, Samantha. It seems like it's just these athletes that just, you know what, I'm going to come back stronger, I'm going to come back faster, I'm going to come back better than you are going to tell me that I'm going to come back.
Oh, 100%, and nobody embodies that kind of mentality more than Josh Naylor, which is why we were talking about him as the, you know, the one who's going to be the spark plug back then. But I'm gonna kick back to Irby because this is his topic, and so see what he has to say about this.
No, that was great. That's what I was hoping for, the hometown love to, because it was fun. I mean, it was just, even from third party, it was fun to see the hardest video of all this to find is try to find his eighth inning double. Because nobody's talking about that. It's, hey, Grant, just had 3-run homer, 8 RBIs. Wait a minute. What was the other one? That just adds up to 7. What am I missing here? And that took me a minute to find that to get to 8. But, yeah, I love that. That tied the Canadian record for RBI in a single game. George Selkirk back in the 30s did it twice. Larry Walker, Jason Bay did it twice. And most recently, Mike Saunders. So, can't say great company, but interesting company that Naylor's apartment right there. But, yeah, this is another piece.
Jason
Bay. Spark plug.
Tremendous.
Yeah. Smith, I said the spark plug. I think that is the big thing here. And in a divisional race that's going to be interesting with, you know, the DN sitting now back at, you know, falling back to 500 now, you're – great series. Unfortunately, got derailed against the White Sox. But, you know, both are chasing the Twins, but the Twins have proven time and time and time and time and time and time again that a 3-game lead is nothing. So this really is a 3-horse race. And very interesting to see how these three play out. And with guys like Jose Ramirez and now Josh Naylor as a spark plug, this is exactly what that DN's pitching staff needs, this offensive spark that can win this division and really will make this race is very interesting throughout the rest of the season.
Okay, Samantha, anything else you want to add to this before we get into the next topic?
No, I think we're continuing with the Deans here, right? So let's talk about another Deans.
We are, yeah.
This is your topic for today.
Yeah, that was a nice little pivot there, Irby, to the Deans, because I've got another Deans topic I wanted to bring up. One, Jose Ramirez. I don't have to introduce him to you, Samantha, of course. But this is a guy who signs I guess what you would have to say is a under-market deal to stay in Cleveland. And there wasn't a lot made of it, at least half that I saw over the offseason. A lot of it was, you know, because of the lockout and this and that. But now that we're post-lockout, we're getting into the season, I'm seeing a lot of conversations about Jose Ramirez taking less money to stay in Cleveland, and it's almost like they're angry with him for taking less money to stay in Cleveland. And I know we're kind of, I guess, because of how baseball has gone, we're kind of conditioned as fans of the game to expect players to go for the top dollar wherever they go. The Players Union certainly pushes players to take the top dollar wherever they go to set up the market for everybody else. And you've got, on occasion, players like Jose Ramirez who take less money to stay where they're at because they're happy where they're at. And I think it's time to stop vilifying players for doing that. He wanted to stay in Cleveland. And I think he put it perfectly. My life doesn't change much, whether it's $150 million or $200 million. My life doesn't change much between the two. He wanted to stay where he was happy, right, Samantha? That's where he wanted to stay. Let's be happy about that a player finally chose where he wanted to play over making more money somewhere else.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, usually when we see a guy take a lesser deal, it's a slightly below market deals or a hometown discount, that sort of thing, or I want to go to a competitor, so I'll take a little bit less money or what have you. This was something different. And by the way, the reason you didn't hear about this over the offseason is because this contract was just signed. This wasn't a thing during the offseason.
Right,
it was actually just signed.
Right.
So
yep.
That's why we're talking about it now, because it just happened. But, yeah, I mean, and I don't think most people are actually angry about this. I think there are contingents of people who are angry about it, and most of them are people who root for teams who were hoping to get Jose Ramirez as a free agent next year, which is not a valid opinion in that particular conversation. So I'm not sure that's it. You know, it's not going to change the market for third baseman. It's not going to allow – it's not going to cause other people to get underpaid. So I think the outrage over this is, for the most part, completely manufactured by people who were hoping that he would wind up on their team and people who kind of don't understand how this stuff works. But, you know, and it is it's weird that he did it, and it's super cool. And, you know, as a DMs fan, obviously you love this. And it's, like, beyond weird, right? But Jose's a weird guy. He's always been a weird guy. And this is what I think people didn't understand and why, and part of it's just shock. I think that's a lot of the reason why so many people nationally are reacting to this, is because they didn't expect it. To us, it's not that weird because we know Jose, and Jose is a weird friggin' dude. He's always been a weird dude. He does stuff like this. He's been saying for years that he just wants to stay in Cleveland, which also damages your value, even in terms of negotiating with the Diaz. I mean, they came right to the table. And, I mean, everybody's been very upfront about this. They came to the table and said, we cannot pay you what you're worth. And he said, I don't care. And Jose, who is like, and I can't say anything about this because I don't live in Cleveland anymore. I have no intention of going back there. Like, Jose, weirdest dude ever, is like, I love Cleveland. I never want to leave, which is, you know, kind of weird and kind of just Jose being a weirdo. But I do think it's also a testament to the organization. And one thing I will say for the DMs, they have created one of the best franchise cultures that I have ever seen for a team in any sport, and they have maintained it for 30 years through two ownership groups, including the uber stingy, uber cranky one that they have now, that everybody there acts like they're happy to be there, even when the team isn't good. It's a really, really good environment. I think they treat everybody really well. You know, I have a professional connection to the team, a very minor one, but I can certainly attest to that as well. I mean, there's a reason why most of the people who work for this team do not leave. They've all been there for ages and have no intention of going anywhere. It is a sort of the opposite of the nightmare work environment that is kind of what we hear about with some other teams where things aren't so good, and that's everybody. That's the guy who's the clubby, it's the people who work in the social media department, it's the front office, it's the ops people, it's the coaching, and they have created this organizational culture that isn't going to stop somebody who just wants to chase money or just wants to chase a guaranteed ring. And I don't blame those people for doing that. You know, they're not paying people fairly. But it does keep people like Jose, who care more about being comfortable and having that kind of environment, and that's where the one thing they have to offer where they can compete with teams with money is stuff like this, and good on the DMs for being able to do that. This isn't just Jose being weird and stupid. This is a tremendous coup, I think, for a team that found a way to attract people to its organization when they can't pay.
Irby, anything you want to add there?
Yeah, I feel like the assumption there is that Josh Lambeau will not be suing the Deans for $3.5 million. That's a safe bet, as unlike Jacksonville.
Well, no one kicked. We didn't kick him.
On the Ramirez's, I enjoy these. And he said it best. I was going to go a different way, but I'm glad you said what you did about that. There's nothing wrong about chasing the money. There's nothing wrong about just chasing rings. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. Go do it. You know, sometimes it pays off. Sometimes, you know, it doesn't. But we don't celebrate that enough of these guys. It's just, I like where I've come up. I like the environment here. This is a safe place for me to be the best person I can be. I just want to stay here. And we focus on the, unfortunately, we focus on the Freddie Freeman's who, whoever's fault it is, doesn't matter. It didn't materialize. It wasn't that as real as what this is with Ramirez. And I mean, the best thing I can do is I'm curious, is it a hole-in-the-wall restaurant that he's all about? What is it? What is it about this? But I would love to know. And good for him. Happy for him. And he got paid. He got paid, as he said, he got paid more money than he'll ever need. And he gets to be somewhere that he's safe, he's happy with. So how can you fault someone and say, hey, you're happy and you're getting paid to be happy? Sounds good.
All right. Well, I wanted to actually pivot to the Mets. And you know, we've been talking about the Mets a lot lately, and not in the way that we normally do, which is been interesting, to say the least. But I want to talk about the back end of that rotation, Samantha, because we all know what Scherzer and Carrasco bring to the table, but you got Bassett, you've got McGill, you got this little split between Peterson and Tyson Walker. You look at three through, I guess, six. You have to look at six here. Three through six, they're 9-3. They have the same amount of losses in the back end of the rotation that they have in the bullpen. The whips, Bassett and McGill at 3-4 have a similar whip to Max Scherzer. McGill actually has a better whip than Max Scherzer. I bring this up because we got the news lately that DeGrom is about to start throwing at 60 feet, and he's going to go in for his monthly imaging. We're getting close to that two-month window where DeGrom actually pitches for the big league Mets. I'm not so sure. I don't wait a little bit on DeGrom here because this rotation, the back end of it, is getting the job done. I think I would rather wait and make that two-month window of healthy DeGrom September and October.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. I mean, at the very least, you are proceeding with the utmost caution with him because we all know he's going to get hurt again, right? Like, I know the Mets are finally good, but they're still the Mets. Like, stuff's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I say this as somebody who wants the Mets to do well. I also say it as somebody who will 100% make fun of them when things do go wrong also. But I love the Mets. I want them to do well. I also love making fun of them. But, yeah, I mean, if I have something that is a ticking time bomb, and you know, we've used this expression to talk about other pitchers in the past, but that's what Grom is, right? That's what that elbow is. So save your bullet. I mean, because if you bring DeGrom back down the stretch in the playoffs when it counts, you're looking at a rotation where your fifth starter, Tyler Carrasco. That's insane. Like, Tyler Walker... Mm-hmm. It appears that it's just out of the equation. They're just there to help you mop up when you need it. You're looking at DeGrom, Scherzer, McGill, Gorilla, Bassett, and Carrasco. That's ridiculous. I mean, Carrasco has pitched like he is the first starter on other people's teams. And by the way, Carlos Carrasco, man, like, what a cool story. First of all, nicest guy you'll ever meet. Have had the privilege, just the best human. And had a horrible time. I mean, you know, he had leukemia. Like, I mean, another guy here, you're going, is he ever going to play again? And look at him, man. Like, I mean, he's the fourth starter in this rotation because there's three dudes who are just, like, stupid good. And, like, okay, Scherzer, sure, of course. But, like, Bassett is outperforming himself. Now, Magilla was not good a year ago. He was not. He was on the wrong side of average. And he's just been exceptional.
Right.
Like, this is super cool. I mean, probably they will all fall and break their arms in the same, like, I don't know, rowboating accident or something because it's a mess. But, you know, hey, for the time being, so cool, super easy guys to root for. It's fun. I love it.
Smith, what it would be, it'll be some weird, like, training exercise where they have synchronized pitching. That's where that will happen.
And all the elbows blow at the same time. Perfect.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Kingsman, only it's elbows and not heads.
Oh, my God. I was just going to say the exact same thing. I was just about to be like, oh, like the heads in Kingsman? Great minds think alike, though.
Brilliant minds. Brilliant minds. Irby.
Great movie. Great movie, by the way. Everybody go watch Kingsman.
Great movie.
Outstanding.
Oh, great. Great movie. Irby, anything you want to add on this one?
Not much I can do to improve on that, except for, yes, good problems for the Mets when you're going to have
great
guys like Carrasco or Bassett pitching at the end. And so I hope, I mean, I was rough on that a month ago, or not even, maybe 3 weeks ago, about, yeah, something stupid will happen with DeGrom. But it's nice to see this move from the 10 to the 60, the realization of, yes, this is a long-term thing. I know that's more that has to do with roster moves, and they've actually got another one coming too, because the relief pitcher Reed Foley goes down with Tommy John today, and so you're going to have another move like that. There's no rush while you are where you're at. You know, it seems like even the division wants you to go ahead and win this thing, because everybody's what is it, a three-way tie at second today, and they're like, the Marlins, Phillies, and Braves all 14 and 17. Seven-game lead. I mean, there is zero push to get DeGrom back. I mean, even if you want to make the conversation of, well, yeah, but it's about getting the highest seed, making the playoffs. No. How baseball is and what you've got together right now, this is all about DeGrom. This is eyeballing September. This is all about getting him ready to
Thank
go
you.
For October. Like I'm at the point now. I'm like, forget August. And again, it goes to him. It's like, okay, what do you need? What do you need to get there? Okay, cool. We're gonna add 2-3 weeks onto that. You know, that type of stuff of like, dude, this is long term. You have something to play for. You're in a position that you actually can play for. I know there's still a lot of the season to go. The way the NL East is going and where you're at, you have something real to play for. Individual stats mean crap. I know that there is a football team up in Green Bay that would disagree with me, but this is the real world. Who cares about how many strikeouts or wins, whatever he's going to get? You have to focus on that long term. And I almost implore the Mets here, I'm like, please don't mess this up. Use it. Slow burn here. Take your time. Because if you get him back, and in mid-September he can find himself getting back into his usual form, I know that's still a long shot. There's no guarantee there. But, my gosh, if you can play this where that's happening, then suddenly those, you know, if the other records that we're seeing up there, the Brewers, the Dodgers, the Padres, and the Giants are sweating bullets.
Mm-hmm. Man, you know, I see all these different, like, you know, these memes on social media about how the Braves have the same record right now that they had last year, and look how it turned out. Well, I can't believe I'm saying this. They didn't face these Mets. So I don't think it's going to work out as well for the Braves as it did last year. All right, moving on. Samantha, one last thing before we get into let's remember some trades. I want to talk about the Yankees for a second. You brought up their pitching last week. I want to talk about a couple of pitchers they lost in the Rule 5 draft. Garrett Whitlock and Trevor Stephan are doing quite well at the big league level. And, I get it. You know, the Yankees are pitching well. I understand that. But on the other side of the coin, this would have been very quality depth in case something happens in that rotation. It also would have provided one hell of a couple of trade chips at the deadline if they needed to augment that roster. So while, yeah, the Yankees are pitching exceptionally well right now, having these two guys still in the fold at this point in the season would have been beneficial.
Yeah, I'm in the same place as you, where it's mostly about the lost opportunity for trade chips, because you know they're going to move at the deadline. And look, Stephan, I think you can make the argument that he could have helped them directly because their bullpen is not flawless. The rotation has been quite good, and the bullpen has been good, but it is not flawless. And Stephan has been a lot better than a number of pitchers in that bullpen currently. Whitlock, yeah, there's not room in the rotation. But who is to say, I mean, would you rather have Whitlock than the guys at the back of the Yankees rotation than Jameson Tyon? Yes, you would, you know? So it's just leaving people exposed to the Rule 5 who get picked up by American League teams who, in at least one of the two, if things break right for them, for the Dens, is probably somebody you could potentially see in the postseason. Like, not great. And you can say, okay, it's just a relief pitcher. You know, right now the Yankees look like they would crush the Dens if they met them in the postseason. But we got a long way to go, and you just don't want to get into that. And I think it's just about, I think that they are not very good at identifying pitching talent when it is not fully developed. I think they are great at homegrown position players, and I think they are good at coaching up the pitchers that they have. I don't know that they are great at assessing talent. And that's why both of these guys, both Whitlock and Stephan, have given interviews since they were with their new teams where they were talking about it in such a way, and they were very gracious. They weren't going after the Yankees or anything like that. I don't think that was the intent. They were talking about how happy they were to be with their respective new organizations and how good these organizations were at bringing them along and helping them to be essentially the best pitchers that they could be. The implication being that they were not getting that with the Yankees. So that tells me something. Not that these guys are bitter, that the Yankees are mishandling their pitchers, but that they're not identifying the talent, and these guys are getting, and because they're not doing that, they're not dedicating the time and energy to these guys. And these guys go somewhere else where somebody's willing to put in that time and energy, and they look like a completely different pitcher than what the Yankees thought they had. So something to think about in terms of scouting and player personnel in the Yankees organization. But mostly, to me, what this is a couple of missed opportunities that could have really helped you out. There's going to be an injury at some point, and you're going to need to do something at the deadline to shore up. They're not going to continue at this pace, and that's a couple of really nice tips there. Either they're helping you by winning games for you, or they're helping you by being your trade chip to get something else that's going to win games for you.
Irby, how about you? What do you think about these two?
Yeah, it's definitely on this end. It's stuff where you're going, man, that didn't it didn't play out, and where the Yankees are, and the run they're going to make. It's talking players you wish you had on the roster, but it's not the reality anymore. And that's where you're at. And it's the price you pay when you go out and you grab multiple free agents. And this, you know, going in a slightly different direction on it. Again, happy for both young men getting their spot. This is the, like, I love the minor leagues. I love how baseball, it's about the development game, and that is such a big deal of bringing players along and getting to that point. But unfortunately, with how the service time is and how long this happens, if you are and it's not just a pitcher, it can be a hitter as well. If you end up in an organization that is not good for you, it's not going well, you're not meshing with the coaches, you're not meshing with the developmental staff, you can disappear and just utterly disappear in these minors until finally you get released and go somewhere where it does work out. And they do unlock that key. And that's why we see the, you know, this tie it back to earlier what we're talking about, Gausman, where it takes years and years and years for it to be unlocked. And so that I'm happy for both players. And this is why, one of the reasons why the Rule 5 draft was in place. To have the success right here, where hey, change of scenery. We throw that term out all the time, and we don't mean it willy nilly. It's true. It's, hey, change of scenery sometimes is the best thing for you.
It kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it, though, Samantha? Like, who do they protect on the 40-man to let these two go?
Well, I mean, that's an interesting game, and something that if we all had an instant moon out of time and like didn't have jobs, we would spend time looking into, like, we look at these things, like, they're like, okay, like, let's go through the Yankee, right? This is 12-year-old me, and I'm sure 12-year-old both of you, too, you know, when you're, like, a child and you have nothing to do, like, let's go see who all they protected that's worse than these guys, and then we would spend, you know, the entire afternoon going through this, because you know there's
Man, can you imagine being the two on the 40-man that you know, like they chose those two over you? You're like, man, I better make it now. The pressure.
Oh, yeah, because you don't want to be the guy who ends up in this conversation, like, where people like us are going, you know who they did protect? Like, you don't want to be that guy.
Hold on. I can add to this. I do want to verify first that I do have a full-time job that I work 40 hours a week. So I just want to throw that out there first. JT Sears and Yordanes Gomez are the two players that were selected to the 40-man roster instead of.
Which one was that? Was that Whitlock or Stephan?
Oh, those are the two players the Yankees selected. Gomes, Yandris Gomes and J.P. Sears. Gomes is currently in AAA.
Oh,
yeah. That's who they protected on the 40-man and left Whitlock and Stephens open to be selected.
Oh, man.
Yay.
All right, well, Samantha, let's get into Let's Remember Some Trades. It's that time of the show.
It sure is. And hopefully this one will be pretty simple because I think you've all heard way too much from me tonight. So we'll keep this pretty simple. This guy, we're going back to 2008, good time, the early aughts, they were. One of the teams involved in this trade is the Seattle Mariners. And this trade took place in the offseason. I'm not going to tell you exactly when. Not yet, anyway. It took place in the offseason. It involved the Mariners. It was in 2008. Anybody have any opening salvos, or shall we start working through this?
Well, let's see. They acquired Quickly in 2009, right? So
correct.
Probably... Oh, man. What were the Mariners doing in 08 besides losing?
That'd have been the very end of the Beltre era.
Right. Well,
I know this isn't really helping me.
No, let's see. Beltre played through 09 there. He played 10 with the Red Sox and then moved to Texas in 11.
Yeah.
Yeah, this
okay,
has
nothing
to do with anything, Beltre. Move on.
Okay.
If it's baseball,
not
involved Adrian Beltre.
Got it.
Okay. This is the hard part with Seattle, though. For a lot of the 2000s, they were buyers early, and then they really weren't sellers or buyers late in the 2000s.
Right. You kind of have to figure out who they are in this trade because there is a distinct role for them in this. I mean, we could have a different conversation about how this trade actually turned out. Maybe that will help you a little bit. They had a very distinct, they are on a specific side of the buyer-seller wall. How it actually worked out for them is perhaps not what one would hope when one is on that side of the equation. So that's something to consider. This was a pretty big deal at the time, not because it involved a star, but because, well, us baseball folks, people like us, had a lot to say about this one. And we were right, if that helps you.
All right, so let's see. Looking back over that, 08 was the Angels division, and it was the Angels division going into the offseason. What were the Mariners trying to do?
All right, if this
trying
helps
to be buyers,
you, this takes place. Colored. This takes place late in the offseason, so the trade relates more to the 2008 season than the 2007 season, if that helps you at all.
Was it post-winter meeting?
Yeah.
Okay.
The action is meant to impact 2008, not a reaction to 2007. All right. So let me give you a little bit more, since we are running quite long. So the Mariners, if you haven't figured out yet, are technically the buyer here. it did not work out great for them. I can tell you that right now. In fact, it was kind of a disaster. We all predicted it would be a disaster at that time. Bo, you and I may have even, like, discussed that in person. I'm trying to think if the timing is correct for that or not. Well, not in person, but I wonder if we did have a discussion about, like, well, this is going to be a disaster. And indeed it was.
It's possible.
Can't remember the exact
timing on that.
Yeah, this was definitely one where everybody kind of cringed and went, yeah, this is going to be a mess, and it was. There are five people on the other end of the trade, not necessarily who the other team is just yet, five people. Three of them turn out to be, well, two of them are definitely more valuable than the one that Seattle got over the course of a career. And what happened with this person who went to the Mariners was pretty much an abject disaster from the get-go. So, what do you guys want? Do you want me to tell you that guy's position? Do you want me to tell you who the trade was with? Do you want another hint? But we gotta move along here. So,
Short on time. Do the team,
mm-hmm.
or is it just a two team trade?
Yeah, it's a two team.
Or is it a three
trade.
Team?
Yeah,
two team. Okay.
One person goes to Seattle. Five people go to the other. There's a 1-for-5 swap. So, okay, in the interest of time, the other team, the Baltimore Orioles.
I'm bored.
I know this. Yep. This was a pretty bad trade.
It was horrendous. And we
For who?
It wasn't Sidney Ponson, was it?
No,
but that's about we're working with here.
Well, it's worse because it's what Baltimore got back. Two eventual pieces that were pretty significant in their their wild card run.
And one person who they flipped later. Two people, actually. So, Irby, do you want to tell us? I will fill in the details. You want to tell us who the principals are in this one?
Yes. Yeah, the Seattle Mariners thought that they could play baseball better with one Eric Bedard.
There it is.
Eric incorrectly spelled as a K instead of a C. Yeah. But to make matters worse, they gave up some outfielder, Adam Jones, I believe is his name.
Adam Jones,
yeah. And then Chris Tillman was a part of that too, wasn't he? That's the other
one?
He
sure was.
Yeah, Chris Tillman.
He sure was.
Okay.
George Sherrill is the third significant piece for them.
We'd not have gotten the George Sherrill
pieces here. That's a little tougher one. Also, Tony Butler, who is completely insignificant. He never even saw the majors. And Cam McCullio, who very, very briefly had a sort of lackluster career for a couple of years with Baltimore, Arizona, and then went on to play in Japan. So, just some nuts and bolts then about this. Adam Jones, who's technically still an active free agent. He is not officially retired. Spent the bulk of his career in Baltimore, 1 year in Arizona, then went on to play for the Orioles, Buffalo, in the Nippon League from 20 to 21. Chris Tillman, another big contributor there. He was in Baltimore from 2009 to 2018, an all-star there. George Sherrill was in Baltimore in 08 and 09. He also was an all-star in 2008 for the Orioles. Yikes. Whoops. So three tremendously good contributors to the Orioles immediately in 2008. So who wants to know what Eric Bedard did in 2008? Well, guess what? He landed on the DL on July 10th and missed the rest of the season with shoulder surgery. And then you want to know what he did in 2009? He tore his labrum. And then in 2010, he also didn't pitch in the majors.
Yep.
So that was great.
You know what?
How long did he last after that?
Well, in 11, he was a little bit better. He went to Boston in a five-player swap where he was really the only name value guy at the deadline. He made 8 starts and was okay and then was basically never seen again. So it wasn't great. You know, he did technically hang around until 2014. You know, he pitched in Baltimore through 2007 in Seattle. He pitched in parts of 2008, 2009, and 2011. That's a split season with Boston where he was okay. He goes to the Pirates in 2012, to the Astros in 13, and Tampa Bay in 14, and he was not of any significance in any of those squads. So he was effectively out of baseball by 14, and technically he never really did a whole lot after 2007. So, you know, those good old Mariners, they were buying, but they were really selling. They just didn't know it.
You know what I'm crazy about? I'm really glad that you use this trade because we talk on this show and pretty much every chance we get about Seattle's playoff drought. This is a perfect example of why they have not made the playoffs since 2001.
Yep. Well said.
Perfect example. Irby, back in 08, there was no reason for Seattle to be buying at that level. There was no reason for it. Okay, you had the Angels who were controlling the division. The Rangers were coming up strong. There was no reason to make that play, and they did it anyway.
Yeah, I remember the aspect of this trade when it was seeing Adam Jones involved, and it's kind of like, oh, cool. Thanks. Like, I know he's still in the American League, and we're still going to see him. Yeah, but
this is what I mean. Everybody knew it but them. Like, we all went, whoa, this is dumb. Like, in the moment, everybody but the Mariners knew it, and they did it anyway. And, Bo, you're absolutely right. This is why this team has a horrendous playoff drought, because they do stuff like that.
Imagine those Mariners teams in 09, 10, and 11 if they had those prospects. Oh, might have been a little bit better. Just as coach.
So imagine being the Orioles and somebody offers you this. And it's like one of those where, like, you can't hang up fast enough. Like, sold, done, let's do it. And then I'm turning my phone off before you change your mind. Like,
whoa.
Joking of like, yeah, we'll give you Bedard. Tell him it's going to cost him Adam Jones. All right, yeah, I'll try it. It's going to cost you Adam Jones. Oh, crap. They said yes. They said yes. What else do we want? They're actually going to give him up.
At that point, you're like, what else can we get? Right? It's like that thing from draft day. What else can we get? Oh, okay. Yeah. We want this, and this. Boom, done. Good Lord, Seattle.
Well, and it's funny is that trade, and you could even argue from Seattle standpoint, like, okay, whatever, Tillman, Bedard, sure, whatever, you know, or giving up Sherrill and Tillman for Bedard, you're like, okay, maybe this evens out. But, I mean, the Adam Jones made no sense, and it's still, I mean, boy, talk about not aging well at all. That's one that's like, wow. Guys are...
Well, it's a losing trade if it had been one for one. If it had just been Bedard straight up for Adam Jones, that would have been a disastrously bad trade. And then they threw 4 more players on top of it because it's the Mariners, and, you know, why do it badly when you can do it ethically badly?
Yeah, it's the, sure, we'll give you Bedard. We want Adam Jones. Yeah, cool. What else do you want? I don't know, Chris Tillman. Sure. Anything else? George Sherrill. Anything else? Oh my gosh, they're just going to get us. At some point, you have to say no, but. Why Seattle's I think it's also why the group of us sits here and looks at what's currently happening in Seattle with not much shock, because we're kind of like, here we go again.
Yeah, and here we are, an entire front office later, like, doing the same thing. It's Seattle. Oh, you start to wonder how the hell they built that team in the 90s that had Griffey and A-Rod and Buehner and Edgar on it. Like, you really wonder. All right. Well, hey, that's going to do it for us. We're out of here. Until next week, watch some baseball. Good for you.